you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for tuning in to the Twilight Histories. If you're new to the Twilight Histories, you'll probably find the concept a little bit different than anything else out there. In these shows, you are the main character, like in a role-playing campaign. Think of this as the first-person shooter of all podcasts. Each show, you'll explore a different world in the multiverse, an Egypt that never fell, a Carthaginian colony on Mars. We'll begin today with a short mini-show to whet your appetite before launching into the main feast. Enjoy. Your galley rows up the Tiber. You can see the suburbs of Rome. Poor farmers stand among the ancient, crumbling edifices, watching your royal galley with a look of wonder on their faces. Or at least you think it's wonder. You look at Jatta and try to decipher his thoughts. He seems curious, but also confused.
"What are these ruins?"
he says to the Arab merchant who stands next to him.
"This Rome, your majesty," the Arab says.
"This is Rome? I thought Rome was a great city."
"It once great, your majesty. It was center of an empire."
"And you tell me this is the greatest city in these lands?"
"It is seat of the Pope."
Jatta brushes this information away.
"And you said this Pope is not a king."
"That correct, your majesty. He does not have earthly power like you or your father."
"He is priest. Trust a priest to run a great empire into the ground."
"Yes, your majesty. When the Roman Empire fell, the priests retained some influence over the land. But they are heathens, your majesty. They do not worship the one true God, Allah."
"Nor do I,"
Jatta says. He stares at the Arab, who bows low.
"I am sorry if I offended your majesty."
Jatta brushes the air as if there were a mosquito. He looks out at the shifting scene. The ruins become larger, the population more dense. Jatta is a striking contrast to the poor, slack-jawed farmers lining the Tiber. He wears the finest silks from China, embroidered in gold. His turban is a striking orange, his sword curved and engraved with intricate patterns. His handsome face is black, and he wears a well-manicured mustache. Jatta is the son of the great emperor of Mali, the Mansa, Sundiata Keita. He is the heir of a vast and expansive African empire, and he wears his power with ease.
"Brother, these people are weak. Why bother speaking with them?"
says another man approaching Jatta. He is equally well attired, though he wears a breastplate and his sword is larger. This is Sakura, Jatta's brother.
"You are an incurious brute,"
Jatta says.
"I am very curious, brother. I'm curious how much gold they have, and how many I have to kill to get it. By the look of this place, all the gold has been taken. So why bother, brother?"
"You've only been on the ship a few days since you joined as the Arab servant, but you are already getting a feel for the royal brothers. Jatta is an explorer who wants to learn about the world beyond his empire's borders, while his brother, Sakura, is clearly a warmonger, who often chides Jatta over his distaste for blood." The Arab merchant notices you, hiding behind the ship's mast. He glares at you and motions with his eyes towards the stairs. You're about to take your cue when you see the royal passengers rising from below deck. Everyone wants to see this historic meeting of civilizations. There's a grinding as the ship scrapes the bottom. The crew press their chests into the poles, trying to steer the ship away from danger. It seems to you this royal galleon is too large for this place. It's like a giant coming down from a greater world where everything is larger, richer, heavier, and stronger. While Prince Jutta may be curious about the farmers lining the riverbank, you wonder if the Romans are also curious, or if they feel something else. The Arab approaches you.
I told you not to come up here when I am speaking with the brothers.
I'm sorry, Suleiman. I just wanted to let you know that your lunch is ready.
Why would you think that is important now?
I'm sorry. Your apologies are interrupted by the booming of drums. The court drummers are assembling themselves along the guardrail. The crew maneuver the ship towards the inner city, which has grown into a throng of activity. Peasants, soldiers, clergy, noblemen and women. Every window and balcony is crammed with faces. They're all silent, staring. Their eyes are huge. And now you recognize the emotion. It's fear. The gangplank is lowered. You see the brothers fighting in whispers. Jutta takes Sakura by the arm and tries to drag him down the gangplank with him. Sakura pushes his hand aside.
Don't go down there,
you hear Sakura say over the booming drums.
I'm warning you. Do not go down there.
He walks himself back away from his brother. Jutta turns from him with a huff and steps down the gangplank towards the stunned Romans.
What did you say about my lunch?
Suleiman says, turning to you. You can't be serious. Right now?
I'm hungry, and you're my servant. Go.
You rush down to the cabins and put together Suleiman's lunch as quickly as you can. The water seems to take forever to boil. You curse the merchant under your breath. He's been treating you like this the whole trip from Tunis. He seems to enjoy his power over you just a little too much. Every time he catches you eavesdropping on the royal passengers, he sends you off on some chore with a nasty stare. The water finally comes to a boil, and you mix in the tea leaves and sugar. You gather together a couple hard-boiled eggs, hummus and pita. You're about to run up the stairs when you see Suleiman coming down. His eyes are slits of contempt. You swallow hard.
Come back into the cabin, he says.
He closes the door.
Let me tell you something. I have an opportunity to turn the course of history. I, a simple merchant, might convince the greatest empire in the world to destroy the Christians. I could do that. But you are embarrassing me. Jutta has even said how funny you are. Do you know how badly I want to throw you overboard? How did I ever get such a stupid servant?
I'm sorry, Suleiman.
I don't care about your apologies. You are a disgrace. Now put down my food and get off this ship.
Yes, Suleiman.
Get out.
Suleiman opens the door and pushes you into the hallway. You hear screams from above. The drumming stops. More screams follow, then shouts to man the battlements. You run up the stairs with Suleiman close behind you. You enter the main deck just as a storm of royalty rushes down. A woman has an arrow in her side and is being carried by a man. The oarsmen are heaving against their poles. Soldiers are rushing to the rails with crossbows. You hear a large twang behind you. You turn in time to see the ship's catapult emptying a flight of large spears into the crowded pier. And there you see Jutta, bleeding on the cobbles, his neck sliced open.
Kill them all!
Sakura shouts, his voice almost cracking.
Kill them all!
The crossbowmen unleash a volley of bolts into the screaming Romans. More soldiers rush up from below deck, strapping on their black and gold armor as they run. You see Suleiman behind the mast. He's breathing hard and his eyes are closed, but his lips form a wicked smile. This little mini was thanks to a suggestion by our patron, Menno E. I gave our patrons the word discovery and asked them to come up with ideas for worlds. Menno E. came back with the winning idea. It also ties in nicely with a massive 8-part show called The Black Scourge I've been working on in Patreon, so consider it a prequel to that. Our next little mini will be on the theme destruction. Come on over to Patreon and add your idea. We're going to start our feature show in just a minute, but first, thank you to all our latest patrons. Christina Olson, Chris Fraser, and Baron von Balbasar, I see you. Thank you so much for your support. I've been thinking for a while I'd like to teach writing. When I first started the podcast about 10 years ago, I wished I could have access to a more experienced version of me from the future. You know, a version of myself with patches of white hair who could tell me what I'm doing right and where I need to improve. Because I had no idea. It felt like I was going through a maze blind. I had a vague feeling I could write, but I was plagued by doubt because I didn't have any concrete understanding of the craft of writing. If I could go back in time and coach my younger self, I think I could save myself years of struggle. Now, obviously, I can't do that for myself. But I can help you. And I want to help you. I was an English teacher for a while, and I kind of miss it. I want to get back into that. So the plan is to take a small group of aspiring writers and teach you what I know. I'm building a 2-month program that will transform you from an unsure writer into a confident writer. You'll go from having a feeling of what sounds kind of okay to knowing exactly what works and why it works. What I'd like you to do right now is come on over to Facebook or Twitter or Discord, look up the Twilight Histories, and tell me if you'd like to join this program. What would you like to get out of it? What are your aspirations? Let me know so I can craft this better for you. And now for today's feature-length show. This is The Road to Tolosa, written and performed by Kevin Valbanese.
Rome, is it? That's what you're interested in. Can't say I'm surprised. The allure of the Roman world is obvious, and there are so many moments in history where Rome could have pivoted into a very different future. Personally, while I understand the constant requests to see a world in which Rome survives its 5th century collapse in the West, I am more interested in that period of transition. It wasn't a hard fall, you see. Nobody woke up in 476 CE and mourned the loss of the Roman Empire. Sure, Romulus Augustulus was deposed, but the legitimate emperor, Julius Nepos, was still holding out in Dalmatia. And even the Germanic kings, who lorded over former Roman lands, paid lip service to the emperors. They minted coins with the names and faces of the Constantinopolitan emperors for a time, and much of the populace continued to identify as Roman. But where, then, do they stop? When does a Roman in 6th century Gaul wake up and decide he's actually a Frank or a Visigoth now? That's a more complicated matter, isn't it? I know you may be hoping to join Trajan on his march to the Persian Gulf or something like that, but I promise I have something worth your while here. before we go any further, please step over to the staging area. You will find clothes and supplies. Get changed, and then we'll continue with your orientation. Good. A nice tunic and cloak do wonders, don't they? Now then, let's continue. We're sending you to the early 6th century. This timeline follows the general course of the post-Roman West until a rather curious development during the reign of King Theodoric. Theodoric, ruler of the Ostrogoths and eventual master of Italy, found himself regent to the Visigothic kingdom in Spain and southern Gaul. In our timeline, Theodoric did little to meddle in Spanish affairs, and his own line was eventually swept away by dynastic troubles and Byzantine invasions. But here, in this timeline, we find Theodoric with a vigorous male heir, and seeing an opportunity, Theodoric installs his son, Roderic, as king of Visigothic Spain. Not long after the de facto union of the Gothic crowns, Theodoric passes away, and now his son is able to outright seize control of both kingdoms, doing away with or marrying off any potential challengers to his rule. But Roderick's ambitions do not stop there. Oh no, Roderick does something rather curious. King Roderick declares himself not only the king of the Ostrogoths and Visigoths, but he declares himself king of the Romans as well. Curious that he didn't call himself emperor, because the fallout is the same. Constantinople is alarmed, though largely impotent at this moment, and the other Germanic kings take serious issue. In particular, the Frankish kingdoms take issue with the proclamation and declare war. The fighting is brutal, taking place mostly in central and southern Gaul. Roderick, realizing he's in a desperate situation, even goes as far as breaking the prohibition on recruiting Romans into the army. With a fresh army recruited from the Roman populace and his remaining Gothic forces, Roderick is able to hold the line, maintaining a strip of Gothic territory from Bordeaux to North Italy. Toulouse, or Tolosa, as it's known there, is the key Gothic stronghold in southern Gaul. A temporary truce is in effect, with Gothic and Frankish officials converging on the city to ratify a more formal accord. It's right about this time that we're going to drop you off. As part of the Frankish terms for peace, they are demanding that a Roman commander who killed one of the Frankish kings be handed over for execution. King Roderick is complying out of fear for further Frankish aggression. You are going to join the man escorting this unfortunate Roman commander from Narbonne, or Narbo as they call it, to Tolosa. Roderick has entrusted this charge to a half-Roman, half-Visigoth nobleman named Cassius Tolga. You will accompany Cassius as a representative of the Gothic court, sent to chronicle the goings-on and report back once peace is made. I should warn you, however, though there is a truce, not everyone is aware, and not everyone cares. Frankish bands continue to raid the area, evading capture by the Gothic army, and even some of the locals have turned to banditry as they've lost everything. The land is ravaged, and many cities were sacked during the desperate struggle to hold Gaul. I can't promise that you won't see anything revolting. This is war, after all, and there are consequences. Now then, that should be enough information to get you on your way. Please step onto the platform. Oh, and a word of advice. Don't be so quick to judge. The Goths and Franks are brutal in their methods, yes. But the Romans didn't conquer their empire without their fair share of atrocities either. the sacking of a city is not an uncommon affair in this age. Rome has suffered that indignity 3 times. But while Rome is no longer Empress of the world, her name still commands respect. And so she is spared the worst destruction. Narbonne would not have received the same treatment if the Franks breached her gates. But as the gates open and the weary remnants of its defenders march in, you wonder if the ultimate doom of the city has only been forestalled another day. You've had no peace since you first arrived in Narbonne, or Narbo as the locals call it. The city had been besieged by the forces of a Frankish king for weeks, and even following a large-scale battle beyond the walls which saw that king felled, no reprieve was in sight. Raiders, led by the vengeful bastard son of the fallen king, had menaced the walls on more than one occasion, and it even saw fit to devastate the surrounding farms. The city has fared little better. Frankish siege engines had blown holes in the walls, and in desperate need of materials, the defenders had pulled masonry from homes and even churches to restore those walls. Bits of masonry had flown in courtesy of the enemy's catapults, and continued to litter the ground or remain lodged in the buildings they struck. You've lost weight, and just standing in the afternoon heat presents a serious test of your endurance. But as a representative of the Gothic court, you've fared better than the citizens standing around you. They are all emaciated husks, and they have not the strength to even wave at the army who has so recently rescued them from the brink of destruction. The army is a curious sight. It's a hodgepodge of Roman and Gothic soldiers. Some men are outfitted with chainmail, helmets, and greaves. Others have little more than their tunics and trousers. Those who do have armor sport gear of vaguely Roman design with their ridged helmets and scale armor. Those armed in the Roman fashion are almost all infantry, carrying mid-length swords and long spears. Others in the army, likely the Gothic contingent, are dressed in tunics and pants of earthy tones, sporting long, heavy cloaks, and wear more rounded helmets. The Gothic contingent are all cavalry, armed with long swords and even longer lances. Goth or Roman, they have all been through hell, with not one man free of blood or muck or both. Out of everyone gathered here, you stand out with your colorful robes and your general cleanliness. You're so easy to spot that the commander of this Romano-Gothic army immediately finds you among the crowd and rides over on his massive war horse. The commander is a young man, startlingly young for someone leading an army. His face betrays his youth, but it also shows deep lines not well suited for so early in one's life. Short blonde hair and a tight reddish beard frame his face. His eyes are a piercing green, and they're fixed right on you. This is Cassius Tolga. Prepare only the essentials. We move tonight. His voice is firm, but even in those few words, you hear a deep exhaustion. He rides on before you can even nod in the affirmative. Understanding that time is precious, you move quickly, shoving your way through the half-dead crowd with little difficulty, as if you were brushing away dust from your cloak. Your brisk walk takes you through the streets of Narbo, past the part of the city so recently ravaged by war. You're in the congested center of the city, where the great thronging masses of the poor and the wounded let forth lamentations without end. Truly, It's as if you were attending the funeral of Narbo. And perhaps it is so. From when you first arrived, and when the siege was at its fiercest, you had much time to speak with the leading citizens. These descendants of the great men of Narbo spoke of a city which teemed with trade from across Mare Nostrum. But as the Vandals began their predation on the sea, and the Goths, Alans, and Suevi moved through here on their way to ravage Spain, the city's power waned. Its great monuments fell into disrepair, and no one stood up to restore the city, which had made many a wealthy merchant. Even the Visigoths, the new overlords, saw Narbo as little more than a backwater. And so, this war may have struck the fatal blow and consigned this city to ruin and rediscovery in another age. Only the church retains some hope here in the city. More than once, you pass monks giving benedictions and singing to the truly unfortunate. You pass by the crumbling facade of a church. Soot-covered priests offer prayers and words of reassurance. You pass close enough to one group to catch the tail end of a sermon. Fear not, my children. The kingdoms of the world shall all pass away, but God's kingdom will endure forever. You find it telling that the priest offering these words of placation has a full, round belly. The citizens of Narbo eat up his words as if they were the blessed manna of the Levantine wilderness. After a quick stop at the villa you were provided to collect your things, you make for the forum with some haste. For the beating heart of a city, it is surprisingly barren, with all commercial activity having halted during the throes of war. You pass from under a colonnade and walk around an equestrian statue of the Emperor Theodosius I. You note how the late style of Roman sculpture put such emphasis on a wide-eyed gaze towards the heavens, with this most Christian of emperors looking as if Christ himself had just appeared directly in front of him. Leaving the emperor's stony visage behind, you arrive at the Basilica of Constantine, an imposing structure held aloft by several towering stone arches. Its bronze gates are guarded by a pair of Gothic soldiers, armed with long swords and short round shields. You approach the gates, and the two soldiers step aside without a word, drawing the heavy doors apart so that you can enter. The interior of the basilica is just what you'd expect. A voluminous room with a statue of the Emperor Constantine dominating the nave. In the various aisles, you see the fruits of Christianization, with icons of the Holy Family, the saints, and Christ himself taking pride of place above small altars. Up above, coffered ceilings reach for the heavens, making the basilica feel twice as large as it already is. You advance down the nave and find Cassius waiting, still in his filthy and bloodied armor. He turns to greet you and hands you a small leather sack and a sheathed dagger. Our scouts returned not too long ago. The enemy marched with great speed to the northwest. But they scattered now. We have no way of knowing if they're actually fleeing in panic, or if they're forming into smaller raiding parties. So, we're staying here then? No. We ride for Tolosa. But you yourself just said that the Franks are still out there. And not just anywhere, but west. Tolosa is west of here. I understand your concerns, but the situation has become more dire. The king's army is holding the line in the north, at Tolosa, Bertigala, and Gratianopolis. The main Frankish army is on their side of the frontier, But these raiders are devastating the countryside without anyone to check them. If not Narbo today, then perhaps Carcassum is sacked tomorrow. And we haven't the resources to meet them in the field. All we have left is the hope that the Frankish leaders will force the raiders to withdraw once we've given them the blood they're demanding from us. Cassius, I understand, but a march to Tolosa across hostile territory is just too risky. We'll both be killed. Yes. There's a good chance that we'll meet our ends along the way. But there's a chance we can make it to Tolosa and put an end to this madness. You're going to lead your men to death out there in the countryside. No. We're going alone. You and I. No. No, 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 no. That's not how this works. Cassius seizes you by the collar, nearly lifting you off the ground. You're the king's representative. You're here to see his commission through to the end, and that means you're coming to Tolosa. I'll drag you to Tolosa in chains if I have to. You throw up your hands and surrender, and Cassius releases you, causing you to stumble and fall to the ground. He pays you no mind as you pick yourself up. Bring him. There's movement in the back of the basilica. You catch a glint of iron and hear the rattling of chains as two soldiers emerge from the darkest corner of the room, dragging a man dressed in the armor of a Roman commander. This man you know immediately. This is Lucius Dago, the recently betrayed commander of the last independent Romans in Gaul. The once mighty warrior now looks like little more than a tired old man, fitted with oversized manacles and a chained collar fit for a hound. Cassius takes the chain fixed to Dago's collar in his hand, wrapping it around twice to be sure. You stand there, unable to meet Dago's icy eyes, so you cast your own down at the ground. Look in my eyes, son. Even my worst enemies gave me that courtesy. You comply, if only for a moment. It's hard to look at the man's sunburnt, almost leathery skin, creased with years spent dealing with the threat of annihilation from the Frankish East or the Gothic South. Not so easy, is it? And if I had my lance... I suppose that's why you work for the palace. Enough, Cassius interjects. He turns to Dago. The Franks will just as quickly kill you as they would myself for this one here. I promise you this. If you don't complicate our journey, I will see to it that you receive an honorable death. Something fitting for a man of your valor. Cassius fixes his gaze on Dago for a long, drawn-out beat. The two men size each other up. The young and beleaguered Romano-Gothic leader and the veritable last of the Romans face each other. Were it not for the chains binding him, you think Dago could very well kill Cassius right where he stands. So sturdy is his body, oozing with violent intent. And then... Dago relents. It's just a nod, but it's enough. Cassius starts for the door, dragging Dago behind him. You know, time is of the essence, so you do not linger. The gates of Narbo groan as they slowly open out onto the Gallic countryside. The sun is low in the sky, casting sinister shadows and silhouettes which make even the most unremarkable tree or shrub seem to teem with malevolence. Worse still, the enemy fallen of the day's battle remain in the field, their twisted bodies scattered about like leaves in the early autumn. You ride on a small but strong horse. You've swapped your ostentatious cloak for something dark and less suited to drawing the eye. You are armed with only that small dagger, and as you gaze out at the Via Aquitania snaking its way into the distance, you realize just how unsuited you are for such a vital mission. Perhaps you will just be another corpse left at the side of the road. But Cassius looks stoic as he rides toward the gate, Dago marching behind him, led by the chain in Cassius's hand. Cassius faces the encroaching darkness with silent resolve. He passes under the walls of Narbo and through its gates, stopping as his horse treads the first patch of hostile ground. The defenders of Narbo, Roman and Goth alike, gather to see off their commander and his charges. They salute him, and he salutes back. The city is in your hands now. Shut these gates and open them for no one. Not even the king's army. Be steadfast, but know that whoever marches on these walls faces brave men. There are confused looks among the soldiers, but a salute from Cassius quiets any doubt. The soldiers draw the gates shut, and the clanging of those heavy doors signals the beginning of your gauntlet. We take the Via Aquitania while the sun is still in the sky, and then we ride through the wilderness until we reach the river Attax. If we follow it, we can reach Carcassonne, and from there, with fresh horses, we can reach Tolosa in good time. And what if we're attacked? We fight. Cassius seizes his blade to punctuate the point. You run your fingers over the paltry dagger you're carrying, and you pray that you'll never have to use it. Now, onward. The road is long, and our time is short. Cassius drives his horse forward, forcing Dago to sprint behind him, lest he be dragged along the ground. You follow, not wanting to be more than an arm's length away from Cassius. You speed away from Narbo, riding along the road which the Romans once used to bind the restless Gallic tribes. Now, leading a condemned Roman commander. You ride for the salvation of the Gothic kingdom, but also for your life. You are too soon forced from the Via Aquitania as the sun retreats beneath the horizon. Fearful of drawing hostile eyes by the light of a torch, you advance by the pale light of the moon. You ride past bodies which were likely felled that morning, and past siege engines hastily abandoned during the enemy's flight. Maintaining speed is a harsh negotiation, as you can hardly see in front of you, and the uneven ground is covered with firm and fleshy obstacles. If you're thrown from your horse, there's a high likelihood that you will break your neck. But Cassius presses on, and Dago follows. The honorable prisoner keeps pace with the horse, despite his own advanced age and the perilous ground. He is perhaps the only man you've ever seen hurrying to his own death willingly. Surely, if he wanted to, he could stop and pull Cassius from his horse. And if he managed to overcome his keeper, he would surely make short work of you. But for whatever reason, Dago continues to jog behind the hooves of Cassius's horse. You keep on like this for hours, with Cassius on high alert. You regard every hill or shadowy ravine as a threshold unto danger. And even as you gain ground, You fear that instead of drawing closer to safety, you are instead increasing your odds of confronting some vicious assailant in the night. This paranoia makes you feel as if there is someone following you just out of sight. Some enemy more suited to the dark and blessed with the patience to carefully stalk its rash and hurried prey. This feeling of impending doom becomes so strong that your nerves nearly cause your body to seize up. But you are delivered by your sudden arrival at the banks of a river. You find some relief, knowing that at least now, any possible attack can only come from one of three sides. Cassius dismounts his horse. He signals for you to do the same, and you lead the beasts down to the river to drink. The animals brush their snouts against the water, but steadfastly refuse to drink, even when Cassius pulls insistently on the reins of his horse. The horses become frustrated, and fearing that the commotion will alert hostile ears, you and Cassius lead them away from the water and secure them next to some trees. Returning to the river, you kneel down and scoop up a handful of water, bringing it to your lips. You drink, but the moment before the water enters your mouth, your nostrils catch a whiff of some offensive odor. You spit the water out, the very muscles around your jaw going into spasms as you taste the fetid liquid.
"What's the matter?"
Cassius asks. You cough and rush over to your horse, grabbing a bladder filled with your meager ration of wine. You pour the sour drink down your throat, spilling much of it all over your face. You end up spitting most of it onto the floor.
"I said, what's going on?"
"That water is vile." You wheeze and gesture at the river, the surface of which has a greasy glimmer to it. Cassius scoops up a handful of the water and gives it a whiff. He recoils, casting the water away. "Has the water been poisoned?" Your heart skips a beat at hearing the word poison. Cassius realizes his mistake, trying to reassure you with outstretched arms.
"No, that's not right. Even King Mithridates would not have enough venom to poison an entire river, especially one as long as the Attex."
"So the barbarian knows his history." "Still, you are naive."
"I am a Roman."
"A wild boar with a Latin name is still a beast. See? You are naive. You don't think the barbarians would befoul a river vital to the major cities of Aquitania? Such beasts would throw any and every violation into the river if it meant the destruction of their enemies."
Cassius paces about, his hands still wrapped firmly around the chain securing Dago. He approaches the water's edge, breathes in the putrid smell, and recoils once more. His face contorts, a mask of grave concern.
"The defenders at Carcassum will have cisterns full of fresh water. We simply need to press ahead."
"And if Carcassum is no more? I had only just rescued the city, and yours before your betrayal. What if the enemy are now camped within its walls? What then?"
"Are you so eager to see the enemy capture all of Gaul?
If the barbarians have taken it, let them have it. There are no Romans left to maintain order in these lands. So I say, let your barbarous nations fight over them until there is only dust."
Cassius yanks on Dago's chain as he marches back to his horse. He mounts his steed effortlessly and gestures for you to do likewise. Freeing your horse, you pull yourself up and onto the saddle. Cassius sets the equine in motion, starting down along the river, Dago trailing behind him. Just as you begin to ride,
you notice a curious form breaking the water's surface in the river. But not wanting to fall behind in the dark of night, you speed off. Your journey along the River Attix may provide some measure of safety against the scattered Frankish forces, but the noxious fumes which you are forced to inhale are presenting a different sort of peril. The stench was vile at first, yes, but in the long hours since you first tasted that wretched water, the smell has become almost material. Even when pulling away from the river, the odor does not dissipate sufficiently. Worse still, you continue to spot strange shapes rising up from under the river before descending back into the inky dark waters. You've tried to raise your concerns to Cassius, but he orders you to focus on the way forward. You continue on like this for hours, stopping only to allow Dago to recover from increasingly frequent fits of wheezing. At first, you'd have chalked these moments up to exhaustion, for even as fit as Dago is, especially considering his age, he can't run forever, even if you believed that his army literally ran across Aquitaine in bloody pursuit of the Frankish army. You doubt that the leader of those men could repeat such a feat in the absence of food and water. You, too, beg Cassius to stop more than once, and descending from your horse, you crumple over, trying to catch your breath, but only end up sucking in more of the venomous air. You even defy Cassius once, so frustrated by his misunderstanding of the matter, and venture out at some distance from the river to breathe in cleaner air. It's during this little row that you first notice the darkness of night abating. Glancing back toward the east, you see a faint sliver of rose-colored light. Sunrise is fast approaching, but Carcassum is still nowhere in sight. Cassius, too, sees the tiny herald of the rising sun, and it strikes him with concern. He draws his sword and orders you back onto your horse. You do not oppose him. With great urgency, you race alongside the Attix River, hurrying west, trying to outrun the dawn. The effort pays off, and as the night's grasp loosens and visibility improves, if only slightly, you spy a large form in the distance. It's a city. The river's route bends, moving south, just passing by the walls of the city. This glimmer of hope spurs you onward, but in your haste to reach the city, you do not immediately remark upon the peril into which you've fallen. Cassius halts his horse, and you nearly crash into him. You're about to scold him, but he stretches out an arm and points to that which you did not see before. Ahead of you, the remains of several campfires smolder, some still giving forth bursts of embers. Whoever lit these can't be far away. That much is clear. And then, as you and Cassius look about for whoever was tending these flames, you see something which turns your stomach into a brick. Up ahead, on both sides of the river, you see the aftermath of a vicious battle. More than Narbo, the bodies here blanket the ground, creating a tangled field of arms, legs, and torsos. Entire siege towers lean over, sinking slowly into the clearly saturated ground. So horrendous was the bloodshed here that there are piles of corpses, breaking up the silhouette of the rolling hills with their morbid peaks. Beautiful, isn't it? Dago stands there grinning. If there are any poets left, they will sing about my victory here. You did this? You already know the answer from the way Dago is smiling. but you press him again. You killed these men
to preserve the Roman way.
I was more barbaric than the barbarians. And in that moment, you understand how King Roderick could so easily sell this man up the river. Yes, Dago and the last of his legions had crushed the Franks and saved Aquitania from destruction. But could either the Gothic court or the Franks permit so dangerous an enemy to share a border with them? And if Dago was willing to butcher the sons of one barbarian nation, would he really hesitate to turn his swords on those of another? You're so lost in awe that you again fail to see the danger in front of you. You only take notice when Cassius prods you with his sword and points to somewhere down the battlefield. There are tiny pinpricks of flickering light, torches, and in their light, you can make out the outlines of living, breathing men. About 10 of them are at the river's edge on the far side. They stand by the water, removing armor and weapons from the dead. Once a body is picked clean, they simply roll it into the river, where it is carried downstream. Carried to where you had come from. You vomit all over the back of your horse, and the unwelcome surprise startles the beast. It rears up and hurls you from its back. You hit the ground with a thud, and the air rushes from your lungs. Your horse panics and rides off, making no shortage of wild and frenzied noises. Seizing on the moment, Dago strikes Cassius's horse, sending it into a panicked gallop. Then, holding his ground, Dago yanks on the chain still held tight in Cassius's hand, pulling him from the horse. Cassius, too, hits the ground hard, and stunned, he loses his grasp on the chain. Dago runs. As you suck in air, you can hear the shouts of the strangers across the river. And rolling over, you see their parade of torches approaching as they ford the river, heading straight for you. Your instincts take over, and you spring to your feet, keeping low as you run behind a fallen siege tower. Cassius joins you shortly, his blade drawn. His breathing is rapid and shallow.
Did you see where he went? No. No.
Cassius peers out from behind the siege tower, and then pulls back.
He's heading toward the city. Stay with me. Keep your head low, and we might just survive.
Cassius pulls your dagger from its sheath and places it in your hand. Then, he peers out again. Cassius signals for you to follow, and you do, running out from behind the siege engine towards a pile of corpses. You cover your nose and mouth as best you can, but the putrid air still pours into your lungs. You hear the men shouting to each other, one commanding the others to spread out. Another order goes out to catch the one in chains. You press yourself against the mound of the dead at your back, and you wait as Cassius readies himself, crouching low, blade in hand. One of the strangers comes around the mound, and with great speed, Cassius rises and thrusts his blade through the man's throat. The stranger can manage little more than a gurgle as Cassius seizes him and forces him to the ground. Wanting to help, you seize the man's body and drag him close, hoping to hide it from the others. He expires in no time at all, and Cassius signals for you to follow him towards an upright siege engine. You scurry forward, conscious of the rising sun at your back. Soon, you won't be able to hide. You hear the men marching about. One even walks right past you, but he moves too quickly and gets far enough ahead that pouncing on him would surely draw attention. You see that the man is a Frank, sporting a long beard and long hair. and is dressed in a thick tunic and is wielding an axe. Another man comes in close range, and Cassius lunges out to meet him, swinging his blade with such force that he takes the man's head clean off his body. What's left of the foe collapses to the ground and spasms for a moment before finally going limp. Once again, you seize the body and drag it from sight. A hand grasps your cloak, and you're yanked out from behind the siege tower. "I found them," shouts the Frank. You still have your dagger in hand, and you put it to good use, thrusting it into the man's leg. He cries out and stumbles. You throw yourself onto him and drive the blade into his torso over and over again until he stops struggling beneath you. Standing up, you see Cassius engaging two men. He cuts one down with a heavy swing of his sword, but then the other clips him with his axe, piercing his chest plate. Cassius grapples with the man and forces him to the ground. Another man rushes you, and not willing to directly confront a man swinging an axe, you run, leaping over fallen bodies and debris as you go. The man gains on you, bounding with feral intent. You turn on your heel, but find yourself about to run into a fallen siege tower. You dive and hit the ground, sliding through the mud, filth, and whatever else saturates the field. Your pursuer slips up behind you and falls, sliding towards you. Desperate, you launch yourself at him, dagger at the ready, but he grabs your wrist and wrestles you onto your back. You grapple with him, trying to turn your blade towards his throat, while trying to keep his weapon well away from yours. He's obviously stronger than you, and he knows it. Pressing down with all his weight and strength, he causes you to sink into the stinking mire. The muck comes up around you, and you writhe, struggling to keep your head up. Not knowing what else to do, you headbutt the man, and this stuns him long enough for you to roll him over. You leap to your feet and try to run, but he snatches your ankle and sends you flying back into the muck. You scramble, trying to crawl away as he lunges, just missing you and digging his axe into the slurry all around you. The man rights himself and heaves his axe over his head, ready to swing down at you. And you're certain that this time, there is no avoiding it. You throw your hands up in a feeble attempt to stifle the incoming blow. Just then, a sword explodes through the man's chest, and life flees from his body. As the blade draws back through the cavity it just created, it sends the man's body tumbling to the ground, revealing a bloodied and bruised Cassius behind him. You have hardly a moment to thank Cassius before a further commotion draws your attention. Standing up, you join Cassius as he rushes over to find Dago wrestling with the last of the enemy, his chain wrapped around the Frank's throat. Before you can even get to Dago, he crushes the man's throat. But exhausted by the ordeal, Dago is too slow to get up before Cassius leaps on him and pummels him with the butt of his sword. Cassius looks ready to kill him, but seeing that Dago is practically unconscious, he relents. Cassius rolls off of Dago and sits up, taking one last look around to see if anyone else wants to try their luck. But the battlefield is empty, at least, of any living Franks. If any of them are still alive, they'll have made good their escape by now. Day breaks, and the sun rises, bringing an end to your long, hard night, but also revealing the full horror of the mass of bodies to which you have just added. Exhausted, Cassius uses his blade to help himself stand up, and seizing Dago's chain, utters but two words to you.
Tutelosa.
Your departure from Carcassonne is hardly the stuff of legends. Only this morning had you dragged yourself to the gates and pleaded with the emaciated soldiers to let you in, promising them that the enemy was at some distance. Your entry was met with apathy by the people, though some of the soldiers remarked at the unfortunate turn of events for Dago. Those same soldiers jeer you now as you and Cassius, riding atop fresh horses, lead the Roman commander behind you in heavier chains than he'd first been fitted with. Reaching the western gate, you are surprised to find a healthy group of volunteers who are willing to escort you onward to Tolosa. Though you find that these men are offering their services less out of valor and more to be gone from the city should the Franks return. After the night's ordeal, Cassius needs a little persuasion in accepting the escort, though he does worry about your numbers drawing attention. Several of the men reassure Cassius that Tolosa is a short ride from Carcassonne, and that the enemy were largely on foot when last they assaulted the walls. Several of the men reassure Cassius that Tolosa is a short ride from Carcassonne, and that the enemy were largely on foot the last time they assaulted the walls. To soothe Cassius's troubled mind, the soldiers find a horse for Dago and secure him to the saddle with fetters. Two more chains are fixed to his collar as well, and are held by soldiers riding on either side of him. In this fashion, with Dago secure, and accompanied by at least a token guard, you ride for Tolosa. The journey is indeed brief, but the troubling sights encountered along the way are numerous. Every small settlement has been smashed to bits by the enemy, the people slaughtered, and every product of the earth reaped. You also encounter more evidence of Dago's handiwork, with entire armies of Frankish invaders serving as buffets for crows and flies. The soldiers told of how Dago's armies had literally come riding over the hills in pursuit of the Franks. Sweeping aside even the besiegers of Carcassonne. There was no exaggeration here. This man, had he not been betrayed, might have carved a kingdom out for himself. Between stories of the fierce battles fought on the walls of Carcassonne and the general urgency of the mission, your arrival at Tolosa comes mercifully soon. You arrive at the city walls and find that while it has sustained damage from its own siege, the destruction is limited. And while there is indeed the aftermath of Dago's handiwork laying in the fields, there are men working to clear the bodies. The gates are open and people move freely, though you can tell that none of the citizens are at ease. As you lead Dago down the street, crowds do come and gather. Soldiers show up in number, with both Goth and Roman alike looking on in disgust. You can hear a soldier spit at you and Cassius, and there are even cries of "Free Dago!" coming from the rank and file. You worry that if you do not get the execution over with soon, there may be a mutiny, and from the way some soldiers are handling their spears and swords, you feel that they might erupt into violence well before then. Cassius seems to sense the hostility, and he urges your retinue to advance quickly for the forum, You ride at a comfortable speed, but do not let the horses break into a gallop, fearing that it may agitate the soldiers into action. You reach the forum in minutes, and you're greeted by a crowd of royal officials from both belligerent kingdoms. Gothic royal officials, likely those who remained after the king's flight from Tolosa, gather on one side of the forum. They wear bright robes like you had before, and look a little too comfortable and at ease with themselves. On the other side of the forum, you find the Frankish officials, all recognizable by their long, flowing hair and luscious beards. You note that unlike the satisfied-looking Gothic officials, the Franks have an air of hunger about them. Or, perhaps, it's ambition. Cassius dismounts his horse and orders the soldiers to bring him Dago. Taking Dago's chains in hand, he leads him to the center of the forum. Gothic and Frankish officials converge on Cassius and his prisoner. Around the edges of the forum, soldiers and citizens gather, knowing well what is about to happen. As Frankish officials get in Cassius' face, he raises a hand to them and begins to speak.
You wolves can wait a moment. The terms of the agreement between King Roderick and King Clothair are that all Frankish forces, regardless of which king they serve, are to withdraw from Aquitania. And in exchange, we will execute this man, Lucius Dago, who killed Clothair's brother, Theuderic. You will have your blood, and we will have our peace. But first, I believe this man deserves the respect due to a Roman of his rank. Dago's eyes widen, and he looks on, slack-jawed. Cassius places a hand on his shoulder and leans in, whispering something. As Cassius draws back, he locks eyes with Dago. The two gaze at each other for at least a minute, and then Dago nods and steps forward, still bound in chains, but walking as if he was a free man before a captive audience. I want you barbarians to remember something. The Empire may not control the lands you squat on now, and in time, you may tear down our monuments and desecrate our graves. But in time, you will become like us. You will build your world on the ruins of ours. But like us, your time will come as well. And no one will mourn you when you are gone. But the laments for Rome shall never cease. And with that, Dago kneels down, offering up his neck. A pair of large Frankish soldiers approach, wielding axes. Cassius draws his sword, threatening the enemy executioners.
I will execute Lucius Dago. He dies by a Roman sword.
The executioners back off, and despite grumblings from within the ranks of the Frankish officials, nobody openly challenges Cassius. Stepping over to Dago, Cassius touches the blade to his neck. Then, he lifts his sword and holds it high above his head. Cassius stands there, blade held aloft for a long time, waiting as Lucius Dago mutters what you presume to be a final prayer to himself. And then, when Dago grows silent and nods, Cassius takes a deep breath, lifts his sword a little higher, and then brings the blade down. You look away at the last moment.
You hear the deed, and the silence which follows. There is no gasp, no cries of rage, not even a whimper. Lucius Dago is dead, and with him dies the last of Roman resistance in Gaul. You are without words. You are so lost in the gravity of that moment that you're startled when Cassius appears in front of you, offering up his blood-soaked blade.
Give this to King Roderick. Tell him my price is everything north of the Pyrenees. So says the King of the Romans.
And with that, Cassius shoves the blade into your arms and walks off, the crowd parting as he returns from whence he came. Back to the gates of Tolosa, and onward to Narbo. And as you stand there, at the end of one era, and the beginning of another, you begin to feel the world melting away around you. It's time to return home, and you're glad for it. Perhaps you will return to this world one day and see what's become of Cassius Tolga, the last of the Romans. But that is for another time.
That was The Road to Tolosa by Kevin Valbenesi. The Twilight Histories is supported through the generosity of our Patreon community. If you think we produce a quality experience, and if you want us to keep growing, please come on over to Patreon and join our community. You can unlock as many as 50 shows only available to patrons. And if you have an itch to learn to write, and you think you'd get something out of being part of my little cohort of writers, come on over to Twitter, Facebook, or Discord and let me know what you'd like to get out of a program so I can craft it better for you. And if you're a patron, don't forget to come on over and add your idea for our next little mini. Your theme is destruction. Go to twilighthistories.com and follow the link to Patreon. I'm Jordan Harbour. Until next time, take care.